I think we're making progress. So we are actually talking about different sanctions. It's not quiet. We are negotiating every single day.
The United States sees some progress on North Korea. It's Thursday, July 27th. This is VOA Asia. Hello, I'm Jim Stevenson in Washington. We're online right now on Facebook at VOA Asia. Also ahead, martial law extended in Philippines fight against militants. Myanmar works on law affecting freedom of speech. China moves annoying wholesale markets out of town. Smog still a U.S. problem. Teaching drones to see. We get started right now with VOA Asia. U.S. United Nations Ambassador Nikki Haley said Tuesday the United States is making progress in talks with China about a resolution containing tough new sanctions against North Korea over its July 4th test of an intercontinental ballistic missile.
We are constantly in touch with China, and I can say that things are moving, but it's still too early to tell how far they'll move. We know that China's been sharing and negotiating with Russia, so as long as they're doing that, we're going to continue to watch this closely to make sure it is a strong resolution, because that's what we think we need to have.
How long is the U.S. willing to wait before you impose secondary sanctions, secondary unilateral sanctions?
Well, I think we're making progress. So we are actually talking about different sanctions. It's not quiet. We are negotiating every single day. And so we're going to see what the situation is. I mean, right now we think it's serious. We want China and every other country to see it as serious. And we're going to keep moving forward that way.
How would you describe the level of cooperation from China?
I think they have cooperated. I mean, I think I was pleased with the response that we got back. We were waiting to see if it was going to be weak or strong, and I think there showed some seriousness with it. I think that the true test will be what they've worked out with Russia, that Russia comes and tries to pull out of that. So that's the real test right now.
Russia has questioned whether the missile launch was actually an ICBM. Meanwhile, the acting Assistant Secretary of State for East Asia, Susan Thornton, told a Senate panel new U.S. sanctions aimed at curbing Pyongyang's nuclear and missile programs can be expected soon. She hinted they could target some of China's financial institutions, and she also said Washington is considering placing North Korea back on its list of state sponsors of terrorism. U.S. officials are also quoted as saying increased North Korean activity has suggested it is preparing yet another missile test. Ken Goss, director of the International Affairs Group of the Center for Naval Analyses, tells VOA's Victor Beatty Pyongyang is really aiming at direct talks with the U.S.
And the way they think that they can do that, I believe, is through missile tests, by raising tension. Whether that in fact will work or not is highly speculative. But given the fact that South Korea has not put much on the table in terms of President Moon's offer, something that would capture the North Korean interest, I would say that the North Koreans, there's a high likelihood that they would probably test. There's no reason to suggest that their calculus may have changed.
The Washington Post reported Tuesday that the Defense Intelligence Agency has assessed that North Korea will be able to field a nuclear-capable ICBM by next year, much earlier than previously thought.
I still have my doubts. I think they will have aspects of their nuclear deterrent that may be making progress, especially their missiles, and the possibility that they can have an ICBM that could conceivably range the United States is a possibility. But that falls far short from stating that they would have a capability to put a nuclear warhead on a missile that could hit the United States. I think that's several years away, but they may have the missile technology at least to range the U.S.
Ken, you mentioned dialogue. What does North Korea want from such talks?
I think what they're ultimately looking for is some sort of security guarantees. I think right now in their mind, the only way that they can have that security guarantee is through a viable nuclear deterrent that, in their mind, would prevent the United States from conducting regime change. But I think at the same time, they want to have a dialogue with the U.S., which allows them to then begin to focus on other aspects of Kim Jong-un's agenda, including their economic agenda. They have moved away over the last few years, away from military first policy to a party slash people first policy, which the driving factor behind that is economic progress, but they cannot focus on that part of their agenda until they have security locked down, which right now is based on having a viable nuclear program.
Ken Gaw said while China appears to be cooperating on tougher sanctions, Russia is playing the traditional obstructionist role that has been played by China. He said both countries believe the North Korean problem cannot be solved by sanctions, but through dialogue and diplomacy. These are among some of the top Asia stories trending on VOAnews.com. A VOA exclusive, ASEAN, China expected to endorse initial code of conduct in the South China Sea. Extension of Philippine martial law signals long fight against Muslim rebels. Official says U.S. likely to target more Chinese entities over North Korea fairly soon. Fairy tales overcome nightmares at South Korea's militarized border town. Jakarta's traffic-clogged economy gets a lift from motorbike deliveries. Expanded coverage of these stories and much more are on Facebook at VOA Asia. Also, stop by our VOAnews.com website. VOA Asia continues. An extension of martial law in the Philippines South through December indicates the government lacks a quick way out of its armed conflict against a group of Islamic State-inspired Muslim rebels, but underscores how seriously it's taking the fight. On Saturday, the Philippine Congress voted 261-18 to put the southern island of Mindanao under martial law through the end of the year and give troops a new edge in their fight against the Maute group in battles characterized by ambushes and executions of civilians. Rona Canoy is president of an international school and part of a political family on Mindanao Island.
The war is still ongoing, and it's difficult for people in Manila to get a clear picture of what's going on. The president or the military, you have to make an instant decision. Mindanao being under martial law would make that an easier situation to deal with.
Troops have been fighting in Marawi City since May 23rd to rout the rebels suspected of forming ties with Abu Sayyaf, a Philippine group known for kidnapping and beheading foreign tourists. Domestic media reports gunfire in Marawi has killed 105 troops, 428 militants, and 45 civilians. In the first month, the armed forces of the Philippines apologized the war was taking so long, but hinted at a longer struggle. Fighting could endure because rebels have received help from sympathizers in fellow Muslim countries such as Indonesia. Scholars believe the Maute group also has enough money to arm itself for longer than the government might expect. Muslims who settled on Mindanao and along the adjacent Sulu Sea centuries ago resent the Philippine Catholic majority for what they see as control of national resources. Many in the region live in poverty, seeding armed rebellions that have left about 120,000 people dead since the 1960s. Eduardo Araral, Mindanao native and an associate professor at the National University of Singapore's Public Policy School, says previous defeats in Mindanao, where 20 Muslim rebel groups are based, tend only to anger sympathizers into regrouping.
In the long history of warfare in Mindanao, when the leader is killed, usually the organization would splinter into different smaller groups. It's like amoeba. They just break up. You whack it, and then they just splinter into smaller groups, and then they form again.
Christian de Guzman, vice president and senior credit officer with Moody's in Singapore, says outside investors may worry about whether the government can get a grip on rebels after an optimistic start in May. He added sentiment toward Mindanao was never strong.
From the outsider point of view, I think the bar has been so low at the outset that the failure to meet their desired objectives didn't come as a surprise. So I don't think there's been a huge change from the outsider's perspective. It's always been kind of negative.
An opinion poll by the Metro Manila-based research institution Social Weather Stations found 57% of Filipinos support the extension of martial law. Martial law allows troops to make some staffing and resource decisions without checks and balances that could set back plans. Road checkpoints and curfews give troops an idea of who's where. Our thanks to Ralph Jennings, who's in Taipei, for sending us this story. Happening now in Asia, 17 people are now confirmed dead in Tuesday's collapse of a multi-story residential building in Mumbai, India. Search and rescue crews uncovered more bodies overnight. Also Tuesday, at least two people were killed when a portion of a 100-year-old building collapsed in the city of Kolkata. Stay up to date with VOA. You're listening to VOA Asia. We're glad you're with us today on VOA Asia. Amid mounting pressure from diplomats and the media, Myanmar's parliament is soon expected to amend a heavily criticized law that has been used to restrict freedom of expression online. But while advocates cautiously welcome the changes, many say the proposed reforms fall short of substantive reform and don't root out the law's core problems. Article 66D is part of the 2013 Telecommunications Act passed under the previous military-backed administration of President Thein Sein. Crafted as once isolated Myanmar began to allow companies to offer widespread and affordable internet access, 66D provides for a maximum prison sentence of up to 3 years for anyone convicted of extorting, coercing, restraining wrongfully, defaming, disturbing, causing undue influence, or threatening any person by using any telecommunications network. It was barely used under Thein Sein, but research shows that, ironically, cases have skyrocketed from 7 to more than 60 since Nobel laureate Aung San Suu Kyi came to power more than a year ago, with additional complaints pending approval for prosecution. The amendments include allowing bail for suspects, preventing third parties from filing cases, and removing the phrases coercing, restraining wrongfully, and causing undue influence from the text. Min Shaw is a member of Myanmar's press council and says so far, they don't intend to get rid of the key defaming part of the clause and have kept the same criminal penalties.
My opinion is not enough because there's still some very wide range of what is in the law. And then the other point is the defamation also not clearly explained in the law, and then there is no bylaw as well.
He hopes that advocacy can still be carried out at the parliamentary level where the amendments are being debated, but he has doubts that it will be effective because the National League for Democracy-led legislature is very centralized. The problems with 66D also speak to broader shortcomings of the Telecommunications Act itself, such as internet privacy and obstacles to tech development, especially with user-generated content on local platforms and forums. Taik Taik Ong is executive director of the Myanmar ICT for Development Organization.
If there are those such laws, what if local platforms that, like maybe local social medias or local forums or local platforms that allow user-generated content? So let's say people are putting up content there, and then what if the government not only takes press a charge against the perpetrator? What if they press charges against these kinds of innovations or these kinds of platforms as well? So that will kind of hinder people developing local platforms for content.
The proposed revisions represent a modicum of progress for the anti-66D campaigners. The Ministry of Transportation and Telecommunications could not be reached for comment. Joe Freeman in Yangon contributed this story and has our thanks. You're listening to VOA Asia.
News is mobile and so are you. Get VOA on the go. Get VOA on Google Currents. Get VOA News specifically made for your tablet and smartphone. Clean, simple, fast. Now available for Android or Apple phones or tablets. Download the Google Currents app for free today. Get VOA on Google Currents at voanews.com/currents.
This news alert from VOA Asia. Australian Cardinal George Pell, one of the Vatican's highest-ranking officials and a close advisor to Pope Francis, made his first appearance in an Australian courtroom on charges of sexual abuse. The 76-year-old clergyman is charged with historical sexual offenses involving multiple people dating back several years. Visit VOA Asia Facebook each day. This is VOA Asia. As we continue now with VOA Asia, to local residents, wholesale markets in Beijing and many Chinese cities are a nuisance. They clog traffic, pollute roadways, and produce noises. These markets might not be familiar to people outside China, but they are necessities to millions of people who run them or depend on them. In these spaces, hundreds of small business owners huddle under the same roof, usually divided into a labyrinth of stalls or booths, touting goods that people here are all too familiar with, like vegetables, cheap clothes, toys, and home appliances. As Beijing explores ways to lessen its burdens, it's moving wholesale markets from the city center to remote suburbs at a rapid clip, and similar actions are being taken place in other major cities. Xinhua News Agency reports that Beijing alone plans to close or relocate 120 wholesale markets this year. VOA's Harry Chen spoke with Dr. Yu Cho, a geography professor at Vassar College who studies China's urban sustainability, about what made the government carry out such a large-scale operation in Beijing and across the country.
It has a lot to do with the function of Beijing to make Beijing be a center of a higher level, higher profit economic activity center. So which means that move what they see as function not fitting Beijing's definition, move them away. They want to use the urban land for high value land use. So for example, if you put them into sort of a high tech zone or financial zone, they generate a lot of income for the local government compared to a wholesale market, which generally is serving very lower level merchants. And the other thing that wholesale market require a lot of logistic support, you know, transportation, storage, and so on and so forth. And if they're in the center of the city, it's clearly generate a lot of traffic. So the idea is you moving the center to other places, you would reduce the traffic congestion.
You know, it's happening in Beijing right now. And why do you think it's also happening in other Chinese cities, as I mentioned?
I think a lot of this has to do with the problem of traffic jam is spreading very rapidly from Beijing to many other cities as more people have cars. And also, I think fundamentally, it has to do with the landowner, which are the municipal government, want to use the land for more higher profitable activities. The rationale is more or less the same, you know, so they want to have the land to use for generate more money.
What the government have to mediate throughout this process of carrying out the plan?
They have to work with the vendors to make sure they have a place to go. And because, again, even though the Chinese government has a lot of power, these are many, many vendors. So they don't want to create a mass incident as it is what happening. So they wanted to at least to make sure large number of them are not going to be on the street demonstrating.
From an urban planner's perspective, how successful do you think this plan will be?
I think it's probably not very successful. From urban planning point of view, the important thing for urban planner, at least increasingly now in North America, we recognize the importance of land value. But at the same time, it's really important for the government to provide services, make sure people can live their lives more comfortably. So moving undesirable people away and moving the market, especially food related, is very damaging. And also close down many small shops people can walk to. It's very damaging for local people who live in Beijing, and especially Beijing now increasingly became older. There are more people who like elderly that need really convenient spots to purchase affordable food and, you know, fulfill their daily needs.
Dr. Yu Cho, a geography professor at Vassar College, speaking with VOA's Harry Chen. According to Beijing officials, the campaign does not only aim at moving markets, but also improve their business models. And in addition, for key markets selling agricultural produce, the city will add a new one for each one it replaces. Developing at this hour in Asia, the Voice of America Khmer Service has learned that after more than 15 years of intermittent talks, ASEAN member nations and China are expected to endorse the draft framework for a non-binding code of conduct that commits to cooperation rather than confrontations in the contested South China Sea. Check out all the stories and features on VOA Asia Facebook. This is VOA Asia. Now on VOA Asia, the U.S. state of California made news last week when it voted to extend its cap and trade legislation designed to combat climate change until the year 2030. VOA's Kevin Enix tells us despite California's clean image, parts of the state are battling an old enemy, smog.
Natalie Sua's six kids live in California's San Joaquin Valley. Two of them have asthma.
We live by the train, so there's dust that's always getting kicked up from the train going by, and then all the smog, and then we have bad air quality days. So on red days, they can't come outside and play because their asthma will be even more active on those days.
The area is nestled between two mountain chains, and that means dirty air sticks around. And there's plenty of dirty air. The area is a farming powerhouse and an industry corridor between Los Angeles and San Francisco. All that translates into some of the nation's highest rates of childhood asthma.
When I became a respiratory therapist and we were all noticed in the ER that today was a smog day and to expect people through the ER who were choking and vomiting and had severe headaches.
$40 billion has been spent by regional authorities to try to clean up the air without much success. The region now faces heavy fines and may lose over $2 billion of federal funds if it cannot clean up its act. Local authorities say they're doing all they can.
If we can get some funding from the state government, from the federal government, we can help these truckers, for instance, you know, pay them half of the cost of purchasing a new truck and get a new truck that's 90% cleaner. So we're trying to get funding and regulatory assistance from both the state government as well as the federal government.
That help cannot come soon enough for local residents. The state says the bad air causes 1,200 premature deaths in the region every year.
I wish I can just get up and, you know, relocate, but it's kind of hard. So you just have to, like, you know, deal with it. It's kind of like, I hate to say it, but you do, you know?
And for now, that means dealing with the health effects of breathing chronically dirty air. Kevin Enix, VOA News.
No matter the air quality, the popularity of drones keeps growing, both for personal and commercial use. Instead of humans controlling them, researchers are working on ways to teach the unmanned vehicles how to navigate and avoid obstacles. In Switzerland, researchers are training drones to recognize their surroundings and build 3D maps. VOA's Deborah Block explains how.
A pair of drones makes a digital image of an archaeological site by building a 3D model of two statues in real time using computer vision technology. Scientists in Switzerland are using computer vision algorithms to teach the drones to see, which helps them comprehend their environment.
We start off with zero knowledge about where the drone is. The pilot clicks a button such that the drone can take off, and as soon as the autonomous mode is on, then the drone starts perceiving its environment. It starts building a map of these visual landmarks on the go.
That goal may be inspecting the outside of a building, or while avoiding obstacles, navigating to a specific place.
The system is selecting what we call visual landmarks, and judging how these moves, how these landmarks move from one image to the next, then the drone is really reasoning about its motion.
The researchers hope one day drones will work in teams for tasks like search and rescue, industrial inspection, and crop monitoring.
Drones can really offer a unique platform that moves very agile and very fast in the environment. It really moves in 3D, so it can really fly up very quickly and gather the overview of, for example, a disaster area.
Already, unmanned vehicles have delivered medical supplies to remote areas in Rwanda and are being used to find animal poachers in Africa. Deborah Block, VOA News, Washington.
And be sure to check out that story and all the others online at voanews.com and on our VOA Asia Facebook page. We'd love to hear from you, too. You can send us a message on Facebook or write to us at voaasia@voanews.com. We'd like to thank everybody listening in Kuala Lumpur, Malaysia, on Helps Radio at Help University. Thanks so much for joining us today. Our thanks, too, to Director Tracy Carter, Engineer Jim Harmon, Managing Editor Diane Gao, Ali Ogden, and David Bird on our VOA Asia team. I'm Jim Stevenson in Washington. We hope you have a super day.